But let us step back, take a couple of steps back, and look at the indigenous world, let us look at other indigenous countries where corporations have taken all the resources they can out of the land and then moved, but they have also allowed these people to become dependent upon a different way of life. And then when they say, well, how did we live here for the last 10,000 years? Let's go back that way. But when they try, the resource is not there to support that cultural way of life. Which brings me again back to my chastisement of the bureaucracy, the Bureau of Indian Affairs. And I would like to perhaps clarify my statement, which may come back to haunt me again one day in regard to the Bureau of Indian Affairs and the ineptitude and the people that are there. There are very good people in the Bureau of Indian Affairs, but not enough good people. The statement of our new, at the time, a year and a half ago, our new area director, for some reason or other stated, I'm proud to say that 78% of the Bureau of Indian Affairs employees are Indian. Ah, but the methodology in which these people obtained these jobs created by the bureaucracy in order to climb up this GS ladder, you had to move. You had to move from place to place, reservation to reservation. And this is, I felt, one of the methods to devoid you of your culture eventually, no different than the relocation efforts, which created perhaps the many Indians in Chicago that are still remaining there. The relocation process was a fallacy. It was disastrous to Indian country. So perhaps I tread on dangerous waters here, but I think it has to be said. Let us not disregard the contribution, the demise of cultures promoted by Christianity. I hate to go into detail, it'll take some time, but for instance, on the Yakima years back, not too long ago, where they would come into the longhouses and break the drums and incarcerate the Indian leaders, publicly beat them, sometimes even hang them, to rid us of these visions that Mr. Chamberlain spoke of, and Mr. Ranjo, because they misinterpret exactly what these cultural people were trying to do. And on top of all this, it seems to be a vicious cycle wherein, in my religion, I guess, to utilize this borrowed tongue that I, without the better way of defining it, this English language is limited in order to define what my people say. But in this religion of ours, I was taught to not criticize another denomination, lest when I am laying cold, my body is cold and my heart is cold, that criticism sticks to my body. And how do I rid myself of it in order to be clean, to get into that great land? So, but I think time has come that perhaps it would be a sin for me not to say something. in order to preserve and protect the indigenous ways and the culture of my people. So the institutions are perhaps here, but they need restructuring. They need to turn their way of thinking. They need to be made aware, but you can only be made aware to a certain step, because, take for example, my people will not allow you to come into the longhouse on Sunday or when there is a body there and have all this paraphernalia you have running here, all this equipment of videotapes and recordings, because they feel that it is not ours to be given away in this manner. Perhaps an example would be the Watusi, the dance that was so popular 20 years ago, made popular across the United States, sold millions of records, made a lot of money for certain individuals. But how do we know that it was not a sacred dance out of Africa? And here they brought it out and modernized it. That's what the fear of the Yakima is in regard to our sacred songs. And it gets down to another little intricacy. These sacred songs that we sing were not made here on this earth. These songs were brought back from the other world. About 3 or 4 years ago, perhaps you remember on television when someone said, well, I think I truly died. And I could see my body laying there. And I went to this place, and there was this door, and they said, no, you go back. You're not ready to come in here yet. Well, they were sent back, and they said, well, what a strange phenomenon. Well, the Indians have known this for thousands and thousands of years. That's where those songs came from. They were not made here on this earth. And the major problem we have in this regard, another contribution to the culture genocide, is that contemporary society says whenever a person dies, we must know why that person died. So they drain your blood, they break your jaw so you don't grimace, they cut your muscles so you don't sit up, and etc. But they make sure you are dead. And so the elders of today say, who is going to bring back these songs in the future? When you die today, you die forever. I appreciate this opportunity and the questions that you raised, Mr. Case. Perhaps in the eyes of my elders, I have overstepped my bounds. But like I said, allow it to be my sin. I think it has to be said sometime or another. Try not to allow this continuation of tom-toms beating and calling rain and these methods of or this way of thinking about the indigenous people and their strange ways. Our people had many visions. They visualized this tautauli. It's a metal object that'll come down the trails with big eyes that can even see you in the dark. Eventually that's coming. And they said this hundreds of years ago. One day there will be a people coming with round eyes and very pale and hair all over their faces. And my father was a little boy and he saw the first people come down on the wagon train with hair on their faces, and he was terrified. He was petrified, hiding in the trees way up there in the brush, petrified to move when he saw the vision come true. The metal object that can go into the big water with people inside and stay for days and days, and it would come back up and those people would still be alive. But also there is this man is made to destroy himself, and one day the earth will burn and turn over, and man will have caused the destruction of himself. But as I speak to the younger generation, do not allow the thought that two men in this world sit with their fingers over a red button. Do not allow this to deter you from seeking a way to preserve and protect your culture and your way of life. Because many of the children today are lost as a result of many of the institutions that I spoke of a while ago. It is no different than prior to the Indian Child Welfare Act was implemented and passed and supposedly enforced. Many of the children were taken and put into homes of non-Indians, but eventually, in their adult stage, began to look at themselves and say, I'm different. Who am I? I have this feeling inside of me. And many of them found their way back to the land of their and their homes, their origins, and wanted to know who their people were. No different than the children of the last few generations that start out perhaps on these two roads that must be walked today, the indigenous road and the white man road. But perhaps in an influential year, the early teens perhaps, they coupled with the ridicule provoked by their peers, they wander away from this road. But through either happiness or sorrow or maturity, they come back to this road. But there is this void here that they left. For instance, they can't sing the songs and they can't speak the language. But they have this feeling inside that they must. And I think everyone, I won't speak for the atheists, but everyone needs to have some type of spiritual assistance and help. So what do many of the children do today? They turn to a denomination they can understand, or they create their own, the Native American Church. They use peyote up here in the Northwest, which they don't even really understand what it's supposed to do, but they're trying something to perhaps that has some semblance of the native rights. And all these institutions, methodologies that have been imposed upon the indigenous peoples is causing us to raise a generation of culturally deprived people. If you have any specific questions, I would attempt to answer, but I thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you, Mr. Jim. Rosita Worrell and then Daly Sembo.
Ted's commentary this morning reminded me of when I first went to the North Slope to study the political development of the Inupiaq. And I spent the first year looking at the development of the borough. And it led me into looking at the traditional political elites who were whaling captains. And so I started to take my field work out in, you know, I said I would start looking at whale hunting. And the captains called me into their organization and said, well, if you're going to study whaling, you're going to have to learn Inupiaq because we don't whale in English. I think that Ted and David are really pursuing a course that I think that can be of some value to us, and that is how do Native people utilize Western institutions to protect cultural elements. We have some good examples of some things. You know, I think one of the points that Byron Malott said was that Native people put all of their hopes, dreams, and aspirations on Native corporations and then expected the Native corporations to respond to all of those needs. And he was suggesting that Native people needed to look out at other institutions that could possibly respond to some of those things. We have an example in the North Slope where they formed the North Slope Borough. They also formed the Inupiaq Community of the Arctic Slope. Under ANCSA, they knew that they were going to get their 5 million acres. With the North Slope Borough, they knew that they were going to get zoning and planning powers, and perhaps, you know, through their planning, protect subsistence areas. And then, like through the Inupiaq Community of the Arctic Slope, there was that desire, that objective to maintain that trust relationship that exists with IRAs. We have the Tlingit and Haida, who under Public Law 93638 began to contract educational programs. The Tlingit and Haida people have always valued education. In fact, when they first met the Westerners, they said, why is it that you're so knowledgeable? Why is it that you have this science and technology? Is it perhaps of your God? And so they adopted Christianity. And it took them some years to learn that it was really education that they wanted. And so they demanded, you know, that educational institutions be developed in Southeast. When, under 93638, they contracted for higher education programs. And when they first started off, they had 30 Tlingit and Haidas in college. And they began to change.
What year was that approximately?
Oh, it's 1968. They began to change some of the rules in the educational programs, the scholarship program. One of the things they knew was very important was that upon the death of an individual, they had to come home not only for the funeral, but also for the 40-day party. And what happened before that was when kids went off to school, and when they had cultural obligations, they usually came home right in the middle of the year and didn't go back just because of lack of finances. So they developed the educational program so that they could bring kids to meet these cultural needs and then send them right back to school. There were a couple of other things that they did, but you know, that suffices for an example. When ANCSA was passed, the issue that I became very interested in was in corporations. Now, how can corporations be compatible with Native cultures? One of the things that I looked at was at Japan. And aha, I said, here's a model. It looks like a model for us where we have in Japan, instead of the large multinational corporations, or they have large multinational corporations, but they also have these very small family-based corporations. And those family-based subsidiaries take care of all of the housing needs, you know, provide loans, and in a very modern capital way, take care of of the needs of the smaller families. It looked like a viable model to me, but then there was one thing that was missing, and that was in terms of the values. Now, most Alaska Native economic systems, their subsistence systems, are developed on reciprocity, redistribution, and exchange. And so they have the value of sharing, and which really is very different than, you know, all you need for capital formation and acquiring wealth and acquiring that surplus so that you could reinvest in that one particular corporation. So there's been some suggestion, you know, that Native people don't like to work hard. Well, when you look at their traditional economic pursuits, there was considerable expenditure of energy. And I haven't come to any resolution about it, but I do think it's, you know, one of the areas that we might pursue either in this hearing or perhaps, you know, at some other point in time. But I think the question to ask is it possible for corporations to be compatible, you know, with it seems to be the thing that is at odds is the value system, and that's the sharing versus the accumulation of wealth.
Thank you. That's a most thought-provoking statement. Daley Sambo, you...
Well, I wanted to get back to what David was talking about in terms of the strategies, and is it possible to have more than one, or to have a combination of the strategies that were discussed rather than a choice of one or the other, like traditional self-government of Alaska Natives before the coming of the white man, where there was a combination of the control and management and the full and wise use of resources, and also political control, and also the maintenance of cultural integrity, all combined, and also including not quite avoidance, but moreover isolation, where they were able to keep all of these things intact because of isolation. And isn't it possible to develop a new vehicle that is a combination of all of these strategies?
That's a question to me.
To everybody.
Yeah. Okay. I didn't mean to imply that these were exclusive options. I look around and I see these various strategies being suggested, and I guess I suspect that the mistake is to put all the, so to speak, eggs in one basket. But I'm just not sure what everybody's experience is with any of these strategies, whether in combination or in isolation, and that's what I'm most interested in learning.
Ada Deer.
Sorry to have missed the earlier point. In your discussion, I hope to catch up with that later. But I wanted to respond to this issue of corporations and their interaction with the cultural needs of the people. After termination, a state corporation was set up. They hired white managers to come in and run our tribal mill. And of course, I shouldn't say of course, but really what happened was they fired a lot of people. There was an extremely high rate of unemployment, although the effort was to become more efficient and utilize modern business methods. This caused a great deal of disruption in the community, needless to say. I should say that our main economic base on our reservation is the lumber industry. We have now a modern lumber mill with computer operation and so on. But at the time of termination, there were no Menominees that were trained to be managers and supervisors. And I feel that this is certainly due to the lack of the Bureau of Indian Affairs training people to assume managerial and administrative functions. At any rate, over a period of time, many of our people did suffer a great deal due to the lack of employment there. And over recent years now, with the Restoration Act, the tribal corporation has a board of directors composed of all Menominees, and people are slowly learning about business practices. But I think it will take a longer period of time, and we need to diversify the economic base. So we're still in the evolving stage utilizing this corporate model. And I hope that over a period of time, it will be modified to maintain the cultural integrity that I feel is so necessary.
Thank you. I was just going to ask Ted Chamberlain if he had anything to add in light of the discussion that has ensued.
Thank you. Just a couple of points. Without getting into the details, and I suggest that it may be a mistake to see the strategies for protecting indigenous values, to see them as separable. I think that there is a hazard in separating out economic control and political control and notions of cultural integrity and isolation and seeing them as distinctive. I think that they need to be seen as part of the same seamless web, and that property rights, for example, need to be recognized as economic and political and cultural and spiritual together, and that whatever strategy is devised incorporates all of those values. That's part of the reason why I used the term vision. It seems to me that sense of how to move that sense of the way to hold to the things that are of value has to bring all of those things together. And related to that, though it's a separate point, is the question of the extent to which Western institutions, laws, or whatever are a necessary part of this process. What I was suggesting is that, necessary or not, there is a tension that is there for most Native communities between those Western institutions, the language, the laws, the structures, corporate or otherwise, and indigenous values and attachments to the land, and combination of material and spiritual rights and so forth, and that the process is one ultimately of trying to go beyond those laws or those institutions, just as, and here I'm picking up the analogy I began with, just as the poets such as Seamus Heaney write their poetry in an attempt to go beyond language, to say the things that can't be said, to somehow reach past the limits of language. I think for the Native groups, the attempt has to be to move beyond the laws and beyond the institutions. The fact that they may never get there makes it all the more important to move in that direction. Just as the poets are never going to get beyond language, but keep trying. And it seems to me that instinct to accommodate both the impossibility of it and the possibility needs to be kept to the center of of things and of thoughts, as especially now as the Alaska Natives move to taking stock of what the next decades hold in store. Thank you.
Thank you. Rosita Worrell?
Well, I just first of all wanted to say that I forgot to mention that under that clinketization of that bureaucracy in terms of education, that I think right now we have, every year we have about 400 clinkets in college. So I mean, I'm saying it can be successful, at least in terms of one element. But I do agree with Ted that it's that the difficulty comes in trying to merge all of those value, all of those systems under one system or under one institutions, and I don't think that they are separable in many instances. But I guess the point is that, and I guess here's the maybe the cynic or the realist in me, is that we have to keep trying, you know, to find as many different ways that are possible while maintaining that, you know, that always in our mind and hearts.
Ralph Johnson, you've been writing away there. Did you want to add something?
One of the diseases of an academic is to write. Well, responding to Daley Sambo's question, it seems to me that, and responding also to the very profoundly important statements by Russell Jim and Tito Naranjo and others about what we're trying to do here, and applying that to institutional structure, it seems to me that a few observations are relevant on the kind of institutions that might be considered in Alaska. First, history, I think in whatever form, whatever culture, shows that moving slowly and incrementally from past practice and from past institutions is really the way to go, that looking for brand new institutions is often a hazardous occupation and does not accomplish the vision that the people who seek that new institution are looking for. So I think that looking at a gradual transition from what is now in existence, from traditional forms, to something that seems to fit or be compatible with those forms is called for. There are three kinds of organizations at the village level, to speak specifically and get down to some of the nitty-gritty here, that the IRA corporations, which offer certain powers and advantages under the federal incorporation, the traditional form of government, which surely...
Excuse me, sorry. You said IRA corporations.
I mean the IRA. Well, it's the IRA. It's an IRA form of government, constitutional. I don't mean an IRA corporation. I mean the IRA form of government, constitutional government, the traditional form of government, and then the municipal form of government. And each one of those, the municipal form of government has the advantage of relating specifically to state government, of potentially obtaining state revenues in support of obtaining state power in a sense, but the disadvantage of probably bringing in non-Indian or non-Native voters under the Equal Protection Clause to participate. That may or may not be a problem depending upon how many non-Natives are living in the area, whether that is important. Each one of these, it seems to me, has some slight advantage or disadvantage. There's also, and I think that David Case might speak more knowledgeably to this, and that is there are definite uncertainties as to whether each of these can exist together, as to what the legal effect of having one or two or three of these is at the present time. They were each defined originally as something that would be complete. They would be the sole form of institutional structure. And when you stack one on top of the other, there is a good deal of uncertainty as to what the end result would be. I would think that one of the things that might be a sub part of the commission's work would be a careful study even a more careful study than the very excellent work that David Case did in 1978, a contemporary study of the legal effect of those, not only legal effect, but clearly the more profoundly the social and economic and religious effect of laying, of overlaying, layering those structures on top of each other, and a recognition of the specific kinds of uncertainty that are provided by that layering.
Just before we turn that subject over to David Case, could you comment, Professor Johnson, on the question that John Havelock raised here last week? He served as Attorney General in the Egan administration in Alaska, and he offered the opinion, in the course of discussion, that the state of Alaska might be disabled from providing programs and funds to native governments, traditional governments or IRA governments, because this would be in violation of the Alaskan Constitution. Is that and Ada Deer adverted to that in the course of her discussion of the institutions established by the Menominees in recent years. Is it possible to tell us what the position is in the lower 48? What is the relationship between native governments, using that term broadly?
Well, there's no fundamental constitutional disability by a state government dealing with a tribe in the lower 48. There was a constitutional inability or a federal law disability under, I guess, prior to 1975. But now federal law has been enacted which authorizes the tribes and the states to contract with each other, so that it is perfectly possible for the tribe in the lower 48, using the tribe as the entity, and the Yakima Nation, for example, to negotiate with and contract for the state with the state of Washington for certain services. So legally you can get over that hurdle, I think, and accomplish many of the same results that would be accomplished, for example, by the state of Washington dealing with the town of Puyallup or the city of Seattle or something of that, or the county of King, the county of Pierce, or whatever. You could do it by contract, but at the same time there's a recognition of the political problem that the state frequently views an Indian tribe as something, well, if they aren't part of the state, why should we support them? I mean, if they're really on the federal roll, then why should we support them? So that you've got over the legal hurdle, possibly, but there is that feeling that, well, if they aren't part of the state and they aren't part of the institutional structure of the state and don't pay state taxes or in lieu money, and there is a lot of that paid, but if they don't pay that, then why should we allocate state funds for that purpose? That may be a misperception, but it is surely a perception, and I'm sure Ada Deer has seen that in many circumstances as well as others. But I think the legal answer is that they can do it.
Daly Sambo and
Ralph was talking about the different layers and mentioned IRA governments, traditional governments, and municipal governments, state chartered. I think ANCSA added another layer in Village Alaska with the village corporations and then also the nonprofits that are regionally based that provide some of the same services that municipalities and local traditional governments or IRA governments would provide. So there's another layer added to that.
Rosita Warren?
Yeah, I just wanted to ask David a question. Insofar as our Constitution saying that the state can't contract to on an ethnic basis or for Alaska Natives in this case, the state does serve as a trustee for our municipal lands for communities that don't have organized municipalities. How does that relate to the problem in our Constitution?
Well, I've never been convinced that there is a problem with the Constitution. It often seems to me that the Attorney General's view of that, the equal protection language of the Alaska Constitution, is a political decision that is dressed up in judges' robes. It's dressed up in a legal opinion. But it's really, I think, underlying that is what Ralph talked about, is this political antipathy of the states towards the tribal governments. Now, how, as far as your question goes, the municipal lands trustee, I suppose, sees this as a trustee for, is the function of being a trustee for a state municipality or a future state municipality. And that state municipality is not going to have any ethnic basis or bias. Of course, the legal theory of native political communities and powers is that they are not ethnically oriented either. It's, you know, it's sort of now you see it, now you don't. It's one of these things that the law is always good at manipulating. But the theory and the legal reality is that Native American communities are distinguished or discriminated for and against on the basis of a political relationship, as Ralph Johnson discussed yesterday. And that political relationship is the process, is the product, in my view, of a rather long history, which we discussed, I think, yesterday in the course of Ralph Lerner's remarks. So the point is that it's not ethnically based. And that's the point. You see, the distinction or the status of Native Americans is not at law an ethnic status. It is a political status. And that is what distinguishes Native Americans in law from other ethnic minorities. And accounts for, you know, Title 25 of the U.S. Code. And however that may have been a doctrine that was ginned up in 1973 to support the code, that's still the law. And I have no doubt that it is going to remain the law. I mean, because the government is not about, or the courts are not about, to jettison the last couple of hundred years of lawmaking in this country.
Excuse me, I thought that that we might take about a five-minute break now, and when we return, Ralph Johnson will turn to you, and then to Alma Yupiksun and Kim Gottschalk, Daley Sambo, and Alfred Starr, if you wish to speak. And there were one or two others in the hall who had wanted to participate, and maybe we can arrange that. So we'll just take a five-minute break and have a cup of coffee.